Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What are we actually buying when we buy into the promise of cheap food? We talk a lot about food security and supply chains in Canada, but beneath the surface of slick federal strategies and corporate-dominated grocery aisles lies a much deeper, more urgent question about who our food system actually serves. When five companies control roughly 80% of the market, and the pursuit of efficiency externalizes massive human and environmental costs, we have to ask, how did food stop being nourishment and start becoming a financialized commodity? To help us untangle this, we're joined by three brilliant critical scholars, food system thinkers, and members of the Future Herd: Alyssa Overend, Charles Lebko, and Elaine Power. Together, we're cutting through the corporate food illusion to look at everything from the myth of free market distribution to the vital push for democratic, community-led alternatives. This is another one of our panel episodes, and as always, it really hits its stride. Let's dive in. Welcome back, everyone, to the Future Herd. This is one of our panel episodes, the first in what I'm calling the Revolutionary Food Studies panel. I suppose I could leave out the word revolutionary. It kind of seems redundant. But I've had the pleasure of speaking with each of you individually, and each one exceeded my expectations as a radical, as someone who wants to imagine a better world than the one we find ourselves in. And Elaine, I was kind of joking that yours was dangerous, if only because we talked about fascism and we talked about capitalism. And I say this because the agri-food sector really seems averse to talking about these subjects and having these conversations. So that's partly why I wanted to get all of you together so we could ratchet up the incendiary language even further, or diplomatically, the creative approach to the future of food. And I kind of wanted to start by asking each of you, and you can go into as much detail or as little detail as you desire, what you thought of the federal government's recent agri-food strategy. I mean, they kind of called it a food security strategy. I think there was a lot of industrial policy with not a lot of social policy. But I'm kind of curious, given that I do want to get into some radical and imaginative stuff, I wanted to start perhaps with the most boring, or at the same time, the most contextually relevant, which is what our federal government is currently doing when it comes to the food insecurity crisis our country is facing. Alyssa, I'm going to throw to you first, only because of the three of us, you were the first to come on the podcast. So it seems like an easy and lazy way for me to start this episode.
Sure. I haven't looked through it with a fine-tooth comb. I should. It is July. Many of us were at a conference a couple weeks ago where the policy was discussed here and there. I would say some of the glaring omissions are just the lack of like community engagement. I think anytime you get sort of money being allocated or distributed from, you know, business or people in suits, I think it's generally ill allocated. I think when you talk to folks, whether it be at the conference or anyone in the food organizing, they know exactly where that money needs to go and who needs it. And I think the further you get removed from that, just the more off base it is. Having said that, it's nice to see the government actually echoing and uttering the fact that this is an issue and that they are putting money towards it. So I guess it's a double-edged sword.
Right on. Charles.
I think you're going to see a lot of agreement between the three of us in some of our comments, but that's good because we can build on each other. I agree with what Alyssa has said. And we'll get into this, I think, in our conversation, but I think first and foremost, you know, there's a real lack of kind of both history and effort by the government to think about food as food. Government often thinks of food as agriculture or health or trade, but not as food, as if again, this will come into our conversation as a system. So I think, you know, it goes without saying, and Alyssa mentioned this, that we need to kind of first and foremost, I think, say that it's great that the government is starting to think of food as food, right? And there are a lot of things in this policy, in a few other policies, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well, where it's a good thing. Some of the language in here about corporate consolidation, about some of the, you know, looking at other countries, about some of the ways that this is being framed is really great. I mean, there's lots in here that I think is we can get excited about. But I think Alyssa's approach also to saying what's not in here is also really important, because it's in some ways what's not in here is probably more telling than what is in here. There's a lot, and I don't want to get into all the details. I also have not gone through this with a fine tooth comb. I've been more reading what other people say about it, because when government releases policy, it's often a lot of good words, and then you have to say, well, what does that really mean? And, you know, how much of this money has already been allocated, and what's new? And then, even though, you know, in 2019, we saw the release of the Food Policy for Canada, which was another big celebratory moment, and there wasn't budget attached to this stuff. So, you know, again, we see this question of, it's great to see all this stuff being put on a policy, but then what does it mean? What does it look like? So, you know, Alyssa mentioned some of the gaps, but I would also point to things like even just the definition of food security. It's a food security policy, and there's no real definition in here. The only way food security is really defined is around, I think in the first line of the policy, it says, sorry, just have it up in front of me. It says, Canada's food security will be based on our ability to build a system where food is more affordable, where we can reduce our dependency on other countries, and where we are less affected by external circumstances. So really, food security is being understood primarily as in terms of cost, which is good, but there's nothing really about food being healthy, nutritious, produced sustainably. All these things that we know are you know, a big part of food and of the food system. So, that's one thing that glares out at me is again some of these omissions, but also, I mean, just also this question of, you know, what are the real actions here? And I think, I'll just say one more thing. I think when we see what the federal government has been cutting back on, for example, cutting back on the publicly funded agricultural research. For example, and then at the same time, on one side of the mouth, we're cutting back and we're pulling, and the other side we're saying, oh, but we need to support farmers. So, you know, I think there is a lot of contradictions in this, which, you know, again, I don't know that we really need to get into those, because it's just ideas at this point. Much of it is just ideas. So, but I think that, you know, what we can get into in this conversation a bit is, I think, the history of government versus civil society or social movement kind of engagement in these issues, which I think tells a much bigger and more important story. And that's maybe the more dangerous part of this conversation.
Right on. Elaine.
Yeah, I'm totally on the same page with Alyssa and Charles. I'm really struck by Carney's kind of bait and switch tactics. So he puts on a good show and he says the right words, and then behind the scenes things, he's clearly very much oriented to the market and having the market solve these problems. So instead of introducing, so fantastic that the federal government has named corporate concentration as a big problem in the food system. So we could be doing lots of other things other than trying to support more competition, which is, you know, kind of fundamental market strategy. We could have antitrust legislation. We could put, you know, profit caps on the retailers in particular. The concentration in the food system is all the way through. It's not just at the retail level. It's, you know, distribution. It's in all the inputs, the fertilizers, the seeds, the farm equipment, and so on. The processing, like two multinational companies process 95% of the beef in the country. There's nothing in the strategy that I saw. I mean, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything about that. The other thing that always strikes me is I think there's also a fundamental tension between the idea of, you know, making things, well, making things better for farmers, but which farmers? And like this food security strategy, it's like they talk about making food more affordable, but, or, you know, cheaper. If we were going to produce food, maybe Charles and Melissa would disagree, but and I'm not an economist, but it seems to me that if we actually took account of all those externalized costs in the food system that are currently, you know, the environmental costs, the exploited labor, all of that, that, you know, is just invisible, that food would be more expensive if it was produced sustainably and more just. And, you know, it would be more expensive. So I think we've forgotten about that, the deliberate strategy of making food cheap, so that employers don't have to pay people good wages. You know, the whole idea of cheap food is, I think, is fundamentally problematic. I don't know how you sell that in a political sense, but if we wanted good, healthy, nutritious food that was produced in a way that was ecologically sound and just for people in the food system, it's going to cost more.
Well, and
that's
I think the concept of cost in a federal strategy could be framed as percentage of GDP or percentage of the federal budget. And I think all present would agree we perhaps spend way too much on, say, defense spending and way too much on other elements that, you know, benefit certain industries. And we should be spending way more on food. And Elaine, I loved how you sort of spelled out the different elements of distribution and inputs and processing, because I wouldn't mind taking a moment to talk about the distribution piece. And I say this because this was another kind of through line of the individual conversations I had with you guys, which is the grocery store. And it struck me as interesting that the government did play up the grocery element. I think, Elaine, to your point of Carney being a very effective kind of two-headed politician, where he speaks the kind of social language while at the same time playing the banker and playing the role of the banker. And Alyssa, while as a podcast, I try to refrain from looking at stats and analytics, your episode in particular and the concept of the grocery as a media environment really resonated with people. It really struck a chord. So I'd love for each of you, and feel free to respond to each other. I'm happiest when I can just lean back and be absolutely informed and inspired. But how could we be rethinking redistribution? Like, is this as simple as just publicly owned grocery stores? Or, as I tried to tease each of you, is there something better than grocery stores? Is there a more revolutionary, more social-centric way of thinking about how food could be distributed? I do want to talk about processing later, to your point about, you know, transnational oligopolies. But on the distribution side, and any of you, feel free to jump in as who wants to go first. What could we be doing different? How could we be inspiring and empowering people to not just see the value, the cost that food should be deserving, but a different political economic configuration that begins with the distribution of food itself? Grandiose, but I'd love for one of you to kind of start us off on that. Go ahead, Charles.
Who's going to jump in?
You never want to be first in these conversations. Maybe I'll just frame a few things. I mean, obviously distribution is in many ways the question, because when we look at, you know, the amount of food that's produced, not just in Canada, but globally, I mean, there's more than enough to feed the population. So I think we need to talk about also production and harvesting and processing, but, you know, distribution is the real crux of all this, because, and going back to what Elaine said, I just want to also, Elaine, agree with you in terms of you're talking about the cost of food. And I think you're absolutely right. If we accounted for all the different pieces, food would cost more. And maybe it should, right? I mean, in Canada, I know is one of the, we have like in terms of the cost of food compared to annual incomes, we pay, people pay some of the least amount in the world. You know, it's not a terrible thing, but there's implications to that, right? And I think when we think about how food is distributed, who distributes it, you know, especially in terms of the corporate concentration piece, it does raise some fundamental questions about why we do what we do and what the alternatives are. And again, this, I think going back to something I'll probably keep coming back to is we need to look at these things not in a vacuum. So we can't look at distribution without looking at everything else, right? I mean, our entire way of life has been, you know, built or like, you know, historically people all search for food. That was our life, right? I mean, I'm talking like in the very early days of human life, that's all we did. We looked for food 24 hours a day and we slept. But you know, as civilization, I'll put that in big quotes, has developed, you know, for the food system is a big part of that in terms of the way domesticated agriculture develops, who controls that, you know, and then you know, to have time and space for culture, religion, you know, art. I mean, that all comes when we don't have to be looking for food all the time. So, you know, so then the question becomes, you know, in terms of distribution, I mean, is it like, does every farmer need to be dealing with every individual directly? I mean, that could be nice, but that's, you know, I'm not sure that we have, like, our people want that, right? So it's I think we're always balancing, you know, what we want and what we, and maybe what we need versus like these kind of different realities. So anyways, that said, I'm sure Elaine and Alyssa have lots of different ideas, but you know, there's lots of, in terms of distribution, there's like the critiques are there. We've named some of them already, but there's, you know, there's lots of good discussion right now about, you know, publicly owned grocery stores in the media right now. I mean, Avi Lewis has been talking about, just did a big piece on, the dynamic pricing or surveillance pricing. And the way that, you know, and then we you know, of course, the amount of control that, you know, a very small, I think like 5 grocery stores in Canada have over like 80% of the market, just leaves very little room for any kind of, engagement or participation or debate on those things. So yeah, I mean, you know, there are other models of grocery stores that have been discussed or are currently being discussed. I mean, there's also other models, you know, I mean, and this, some of these are in the food strategy, things like food hubs or like other forms of distribution that have been very successful in other places. And the Ontario Food Terminal is a great model for that. When I lived in Toronto, you know, you could go literally to almost any corner store on any street and they have fresh vegetables because any business could go there. And I now live in Northern Ontario and, you know, outside of the grocery stores, there's very few options to go to get food. So, you know, there are those kind of distributions. There are other kinds of distributions, you know, more direct to consumer, like community shared agriculture, where farmers are working directly with a whole community of consumers to distribute food and grow what people need. And, you know, and I think all of those, I don't want to suggest that like we can like one of those is perfect for everyone, but I think ultimately, you know, having multiple options available for people, especially ones that allow eaters and farmers and growers and harvesters and Indigenous people to have more say, have more control over those systems, is foundational. And I think this is ultimately, and I'll finish with this, but this is ultimately the problem with a lot of this policy, these policies, is they tend to be quite top down. They tend to be quite, you know, as others have said already, very market based, very kind of, I would even say like post neoliberal in their approaches, as opposed to, you know, taking a full systems approach and actually engaging with those and really letting those lead, like farmers, fishers, Indigenous people, who have been providing food for humanity since time immemorial.
I'll jump in as I'm currently on the East Coast and Scotia, and there was in the 1930s when, you know, the global economy collapsed, there was a real movement, a co-op movement that developed here, and with among fishermen, fisherfolk, but also there's been a co-op grocery store chain in Atlantic Canada for it's. And I was in the, you know, in the discussion about public grocery stores, I'm not convinced that they're going to work, especially in isolation from other policies of like antitrust or competition. So for example, the Atlantic Co-op grocery stores, which are still around, but they were bought by Sobeys in 2015. It's like, oh, shit. You know, like Sobeys went on a big spending spree. They bought Farm Boy in Ontario. I think they bought Safeway out west. I don't know. But, if they're successful without legislation to prevent it, they're going to get gobbled up by bigger retailers. So co-op is one potential alternative distribution model, but I'm with Charles that I think, you know, maybe the federal government could talk to people, talk to farmers, talk to fishers, talk to indigenous people, talk to consumers to see what would be better. I think obviously it could be that what's going to work here in Cape Breton is not going to work in Northern Ontario. I don't know. I mean, but yeah, I think as long as food is commodified and financialized, it's there's going to be profit seeking. So, and that's where a lot of our problems lie. So we're back to capitalism.
I have a lot of thoughts. I'll try to make them coherent. Jesse, your question is obviously a big one, and one that I get, you know, from friends and family and students. And I think the question of social change is always what Elaine alluded to. It's a, you know, you attack it from multiple angles. I think it would be great to see, and there are some great food co-ops, and I think they kind of hold on by many threads. Mm-hmm. And also consumers have a play in all of this in where we put our purchasing power. I think that is something we can always remind people of. Certainly, it would be great to see more landmark cases. And Elaine, you may know more about this being an East Coaster, but the Mi'kmaq and the Ocean Wise, there was a landmark case where that the shares were split 50%. I'm like, for some of the lobster fisheries, that could be a great model. And that's, again, like actually working with Indigenous groups and corporations. Again, there may be issues, or it's not a perfect system. There's never a perfect system, but it may be better than. I think some of the focus on public grocery stores or even the role of large grocery chains, we talk about food waste a lot and then the lack of food that a lot of food banks have. Well, to me, that seems like an obvious, if grocery stores are wasting half of what they put out and food banks are struggling, why can't we actually link those two more formally, again, from a policy level? I think social change has to come top down and bottom up. I think there's a lot of great grassroots work happening. And certainly the Food Studies Forum reminded me of that. Food Studies people are passionate. A lot of these organizations are held together by passion projects, and that's great. But again, we also need to see that sort of top-down model. In terms of why people would seek out alternative food systems, you know, grocery stores are pretty sterile environments. I think a lot of how people engage in the world are increasingly disconnected. And I think there's a kind of sixth factor to going to a farmer's market and seeing communities and families and talking to your farmer. And I think sometimes some of those social change pieces happen when people taste what farmer's market produce tastes like, and it's vastly different than your commercial grocer, or they have a conversation with their farmer. I think there's that community piece, I guess, that you can't reproduce in a corporate system, and hopefully that draws people as well. I guess the last thing I would kind of say, it ties a little bit in with Indigenous framings of food, but food ultimately is a gift. And the fact that we've moved it so far into this sort of massively corporatized resource and resource extraction, I think we need to kind of bring back some of those more holistic understandings of food. You know, having said that, grocery stores also with Gen Z are not even being used. They're sort of jumping ahead even to things like food delivery and Uber Eats and that. So I kind of wonder if there's even more of a shift to even more removed from food sources than grocery stores themselves. So I guess there's some light spots and some darker spots depending on where you look in this conversation.
Right on. Go ahead, Alyssa.
Can I jump? I'm gonna jump back in again because Jesse, we talked in our one-on-one about the invisible labor. I mean, all of us clearly care about food. We care about good food and healthy food. I'm thinking about the low-income family working two or three jobs and with kids and all these other responsibilities and. I wonder if we can really change the food system without changing the larger society and the larger culture and the structure. Like when people are like working and commuting, and like just they're tired at the end of the day. And the less, not everybody has the skills to, go to the farmer's market. The time, the leisure. I mean, of course, the critique is that it's elitist, and it doesn't account for some of the other things that are going on in most people's lives. So, I don't have any answers.
Time poverty is definitely a thing. I was kind of curious, if we look at farmers market produce compared to grocery store produce, is there a price difference? Is there a price point difference as much as there used to be? Food doesn't necessarily have to cost more. I think with like beef and some of the higher value items there is, but I think in terms of produce, we're starting to see that. But then, of course, as you say, it's location of farmers markets. They're not on bus routes or subway routes and the time certainly to go and procure that food.
So before I throw to you, Charles, let me tease out something Alyssa said that I want you guys to sort of feel empowered by. Because Alyssa said something that you don't often hear in kind of a left wing or radical circles, which is the role of top-down policy. And that is one thing I want to indulge in today's episode, because the reason I wanted to focus on distribution is I genuinely think that the grocery oligopoly is vulnerable. Everyone I've seen across the agri-food sector, let alone the general population, kind of has a problem with them, has a critique, has some issue. And I think that on a public policy level really makes them vulnerable. So I appreciate the kind of environment scan we've been doing and talking about the different alternatives. And I also appreciate how we're emphasizing the role of culture and community and locality. But Charles, without derailing what you were going to say, allow me to empower you with the idea that if we did have the power of the state, if we did have the ability to talk about policy and regulation in a powerful manner, in concert with the bottom up, what could that look like? I would love to empower this discussion with that context. Go ahead, Charles.
I think it's a great point, and I often lament that as activists, I'll say we and many activists we dismiss the state too quickly in the sense that we talk about systems change, and I was going to pick up on Elaine's point about just kind of where I started too, is like if you want to change the food system, you kind of got to change everything. It's not just about like food is kind of connected to everything. But if we want to change systems, the way we do that is we engage with policy. Not the only way, of course, but that's part of the way. I mean, because a lot of the ways that our activities, behaviors, even our economic systems are constrained or enabled is through policy. So, I would never say like that is the only thing to do, but again, I think that is a big part of it. And, I think, when we look, I mean, I also think we need to go back historically, I mean, food is, again, has been and is a way to control populations. And that has happened throughout, you know, for good and for bad. I mean, whether it's government providing the things that we need or whether it's using food to harm populations. I mean, you know, Canada has a horrible legacy of Indigenous people being, you know, I mean, I would argue as part of a genocide, being having food systems, food structures kind of destroyed, held back from them. You know, there's a great, the Jim Daszak's book, Clearing the Plains, tells a lot of that story in central Canada about Canada's, you know, the active role that authorities played in destroying populations. You know, I mean, we don't have to look any farther than the Israeli government's actions in Palestine, which are also using food as part of a genocide to control populations. So there is this history of the way that's been used negatively. And I would argue it's still happening today. I mean, I gave the example of Israel. I think even in Canada, you know, a lot of fishers, I've been doing a lot of work with Indigenous fishers who like can't sell or, you know, even trade much of their fish without kind of government permission. And it, that varies a little bit throughout provinces, but it's pretty similar. So there's that issue. But, you know, I think governments do, if we want to even talk about the right to food, you know, which is guaranteed in the Declaration of Human Rights and other subsequent declarations. I mean, the government does have a role to protect that right so that all people have access to the food they need in sufficient amounts and culturally appropriate foods, etc. But in terms of policy, I think the government also, you know, a lot of times when we look at policy, we've already named a few, policy can be very restrictive in terms of allowing people to do the things, and farmers and fishers and Indigenous people and eaters to do the things they need to do. But, you know, it also can be enabling. And I think that's where we need to, that's where we can think about kind of the opportunities to engage with government. You know, I do believe, maybe I don't want to open a whole can of worms, but like, you know, I teach at a health sciences department, and I do believe it's really great to walk into a restaurant and know that I'm not going to get sick and die, you know, from like eating something, you know, like, I mean, if we all had to do that, like our own research, I mean, that's just dangerous business. So, you know, the fact that we have public health, the fact that we have, you know, protections against, you know, food related activities that harm the environment, you know, harm our health, et cetera. And of course, all of this is fraught. I'm not totally saying it's great, but you know, this is where government could step in. I just want to say one more thing. And you know, there was in 2021, after the Food Policy for Canada was released, the government of Canada did create a Canadian Food Policy Advisory Council, which was made up of, you know, nominated people from all over the country, from coast to coast to coast. And it was a really, at the time, it was something that was proposed by a network of non-governmental people who were actively engaged in discussions about food sovereignty and kind of food systems work. And it was and then there was a round of nominations, people were selected. And for a while, it was actually a very, I would argue, like a successful or at least really valuable initiative, but that has kind of floundered. And you know, this amazing policy, there was a second round of nominations. Nobody was brought into the council. The council hasn't met in a few years. And you know, talking to some of the people who are on it, they're very frustrated because they weren't allowed. You know, there's a lot. Anyways, I won't get into all the details, but it's challenging. I think when like there are opportunities, there are enabling practices, you know, policies that are out there, could be out there. You know, if we talked about you know, environment, health, more than we talked about economic profit, I think that we're talking about a whole different set of policies. And then these initiatives like the Canadian Food Policy Advisory Council, those kinds of initiatives, you know, Elaine, you also said, like talking to these people, like there needs to be mechanisms set up that are not just, you know, we have an idea, we're gonna go talk to 10 people and see what they think and then create this system, because ultimately it's industry that gets the bigger voice. They have, you know, paid people who know exactly what to do, how to do it, versus, you know, having the opportunity to really engage with people. And, you know, one thing I'll just say very quickly is, like, you know, in 2011, the People's Food Policy was released, a document called Resetting the Table. And that was an amazing kind of initiative, again, by nonprofits and small businesses and farmers and fishers, and led by the Indigenous Advisory Council, that brought together people from coast to coast to coast to talk about these things, to talk about policy, to talk about directions they wanted things to go. And again, I'm just naming that because there are, like, it's not like we've never done this or nobody's ever had that idea. These things existed. But unfortunately, they just, like, when it comes to government, we you know, it kind of flips. And I think, you know, we've already talked about this policy, this new food security policy, it flips into almost just like economics, you know, benefiting industry and not really addressing the real issue. So it becomes a lot of business as usual, as opposed to really kind of addressing the real issues. Anyway, sorry, Elaine, I think you wanted to, we're going to jump in.
Can I jump in, Jesse? Because I think, you know, I just want to expand on something Charles said. I'm old now. I think maybe I might have been naive, or maybe the times also changed. I used to think government actually was interested in creating the conditions people could thrive, you know, be healthy and thrive. And I don't, like, say maybe I was just naive, or maybe. Things have changed, but I really believe very strongly that all levels of government have now been captured by corporate interests, and so economics and profit, as Charles said, it's the government's role. Seems to see itself, and Carney seems to see himself as, you know, enabling corporations to make more money, as opposed to, so I would say, in terms of policy, if we had policy that enabled and empowered people and food growers and food harvesters, and, you know, but enabled, that was focused on people, like bringing out the best in us, supporting us to have good lives, to thrive and survive and have good food. And then disempowering or putting restrictions on corporate power. So I would like to see public policy that supports a lot of public health, social determinants of health, thinking about, like, why isn't the health of the population the overall goal and orientation of government, which I think it should be. And then corporations are regulated to serve our interests, however we understand that. So that could also be, you know, Jesse, we talked about, you know, the threats to democracy, but this would actually be, you know, we've talked a lot about how food is a connector, is an entryway into so many kinds of discussions and, you know, all the topics. This would be an amazing way to start kind of reinvigorating democracies. Like, how do we want to think about food system in relation to population health and how to make population healthier. Just, yeah, as Charles said, it's not like these are new ideas, and the technology that we have now makes it so much easier to have these kinds of big discussions at large scale. So that's my two cents. I want to see public policy that supports people to live their best lives.
Well, and if I could quickly jump in before I throw to you, Alyssa, I think it's worth noting that it's in the U.S., but also here in Canada, the far right, most embodied by RFK Jr., has successfully mobilized a kind of anti-corporate, pro-health narrative. Granted, still focused on profit and heavily laced with conspiracy. But I treat it as a symptom that there is an opportunity on the left to also try to look at health. I think we should include community, right? And a kind of bottom-up democratic empowerment with that. But I do think that the corporate economic-centric worldview is threatened, both by climate change and by wealth concentration. With that said, Alyssa, please, I suspect you have much more to add to the conversation. And I think what I'm really enjoying about this is how we're weaving together the top to down, the bottom, the up, the cultural, the political, the economic, and I hope developing a worldview, developing a narrative that can empower not just us as radicals within the food system, but the sector as a whole. Because that's why I'm using this podcast to have these conversations. I don't think we're at the margins anymore. I think the center is collapsing. And as a consequence, our perspective and our analysis is actually more accessible and relevant than ever. Not to hype you up too much, Alyssa, but please jump into the conversation.
Well, I think power is always what we speak about and the kinds of things we talk about or don't talk about. So I agree with you there. I also think food studies is having a moment. I'm hearing people talk about these issues that historically haven't. So that's nice to see. My colleagues are completely right. Food is already highly regulated. And I think we only need to look at recent sort of government policies. So the collapse of the wheat board through the Harper government years is one way that we see GMO wheat entering and canola and soy and all of these things. And I think a lot of Canadians still don't realize that that's happening. I think the recent Canada-US-Mexico agreement that Trudeau pushed in before leaving allowed American dairy access to Canadian markets. I think a lot of Canadians don't realize that. And so when I advocate for sort of the government involvement, it's at that level, certainly in consultation with communities and people doing this work on the ground. Looking at what's legal, even in European countries, I think some of the food quality is better. They have stronger regulations. And I think that's where we need the government to sort of stand in as a regulator in terms of what gets in and what doesn't. And we're not in those rooms. So I think a lot of, you know, Canadians would be on board with having more stringent policies on not having RGBH, which is the controversial growth hormone in American beef and American dairy that's on our shelves, not having stronger regulations around labeling. I think a lot of people are really confused about that. I think we need that larger macro level form of power to have some say. And I think food stuff does get shifted around in some of these large arrangements. And then the other piece, you know, I think about, you know, good food requires land. And some of the issues that we're seeing now around, especially in Alberta, AI data centers, and what's that going to do to wildlife and ecosystems and land quality. And yeah, it doesn't seem related to food, but it absolutely is. And it's terrifying. You know, oil is terrifying. And that seems not that bad in comparison to some of the AI discussions and these mega centers that are happening. Jesse, you're absolutely right. The US is very much a canary in the coal mine. You want to look at the downsides of our food system and the effects on health. Just look at what's happening in the US in terms of centralization of food power and feedlots, and then the health of the American population on top of that. Obviously, it's more complicated, but their food system is terrible. One of the FIFA World Cup players had food flown in from Denmark because he didn't want to eat U.S. food. And I'm like, you know, good on him. If people can do that, why not?
I'm going to jump in, Jesse, because I wanted to name a policy that I think we have all advocated for, and that's basic income. So that's a very clear kind of policy that the federal government could implement that would have, you know, transformative effects for everybody in Canada, for consumers and producers. So that seems like a really good, to me, a really good example of that it could be revolutionary.
And the evidence is there. Like, as you know, Elaine, the evidence is there. It works.
Yeah.
So Charles,
that's why it's terrifying to the powers that be. Yeah.
But before I throw to you, Charles, I want to amplify something Alyssa said and sort of, you know, encourage you in our aspirational tone here to really embrace it. I think we can accept that a lot of the public policy conversations have not included the right people in the room, or more specifically, have deliberately excluded people from the room who would offer criticism, who would offer dissent. So, Charles, I want you to, as part of your sharing your thoughts, to add in the aspect of what is our argument as to why that exclusion can't happen anymore, as to why, whether it's us or whether it's other people, there needs to be, as we've been saying, a more community-centric, more bottom-up approach. And the concept, which I'll throw at you, which you can toss right out, I mean, aside from the fact that there are many people, myself included, who would like to see the police abolished entirely, most people do think that civilian oversight of police is an appropriate policy. Is civilian oversight of grocery stores a viable concept? Or a civilian oversight of the distribution of food within our communities? Is that too crazy? Not to preclude what you were going to say, by all means, I suspect you're going to have a lot to say. I just wanted to throw my own query into the mix.
Yeah. I want to, well, let me start with a comment you made before, because I think it relates to this, is around like the whole MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again stuff. Because ultimately, I think it's an interesting kind of paradox of, you know, exactly what we're talking about, like, you know, the need for civilian oversight and people need to speak. And you have these, like, you know, people on social media say, oh, we need, you know, more of this and, you know, more or less this. And then you have government in many ways, like, you know, fostering, you know, like control, but then the conspiracy theories. I mean, there's a lot going on there. Anyways, we don't have a ton of time to get into. But I think, you know, the danger of just saying civilian oversight is the answer is that, you know, people know what they know. They know their experiences, and that's good and that's important, but that's not the whole picture, right? And I want to make I'll get to your other point in a second, but I do want to make a case for evidence, and Alyssa, you said this, like evidence-based decision-making. And I want to be clear what I mean by evidence-based, because that's also a bit of a fraught concept. But when I say evidence-based, I mean like both evidence in terms of research, evidence in terms of indigenous knowledge and experience, evidence in terms of like, basically I'll say all ways of knowing, right? But not just, oh, like I read this thing or I heard this thing or this is the latest, because ultimately I think we get into the danger of people being manipulated a lot by going back to what we did, by power, by money, by all these things. So when I say evidence, I've heard the term like ethics-based decision-making, right? Although, you know, the more terms we start bringing in, the more subjective we get. But the point is, I think having, you know, decision-making and policy that's based on based on kind of real evidence, again, from many ways of knowing. And, you know, Elaine's point about basic income. I mean, there's been so many, every time we talk about basic income, I think it comes up, we don't need more studies. Like, we have the evidence. The evidence is out there. We've done the research. We've talked to people. We've gathered the information. Yet government is still so hesitant to move on that. And there's, you know, there's been lots of movement at the federal level, the provincial level as well. But then, you know, governments, you know, the Ford government canceled the basic income pilot, you know, there's a case in PEI that's being developed. There's all this kind of work in progress that just keeps getting kind of shut down. And then that speaks to, again, like this idea of the right people in the room and who's been excluded. And for a long time, you know, I'll just tell a quick anecdote. When we were doing the consultations for the Food Policy for Canada, I was invited as a group of civil society folks to kind of day long government consultation. It was, you know, I remember being very excited about it, and we did some pre-training and we gathered Food Secure Canada, National Food Movement Organization, gathered us together, and there were about 100 of us in the room, and we talked about even like, you know, like when you get in the room, like there's gonna be a lot of different voices and we need to make sure we do speak. And like, they were even talking about like, make sure to like be the note recorder, because then you can actually make sure the right things. So we had all these plans, we were kind of prepped, and we did our, we got there, and we were all very shocked that there were almost zero industry in the room. There were no lawyers in the room. There were no kind of professional advocates in the room. And I remember talking about this after, and what we realized was those folks don't need to be in this room, because they have the ear of government all the time. This is not a productive use of their time. So we basically had this amazing conversation with, you know, hundreds of people from across the country, from different communities, different groups, different, even small, like farmers and indigenous groups and fishers, you know, nonprofits. And at the end of the day, we all agree, really, this is great. Everyone agrees. And then, of course, then the real voices come in and, you know, are meeting with government and their backroom deals and, you know, whatnot. So, you know, it's not that necessarily people are being excluded. It's just that, I mean, they are being excluded very deliberately, but, you know, in the end, like they're often in the room. They just don't, their voices, they just don't have the tools, the voices, you know, government is not listening to them. In that sense, do we need civilian oversight? I mean, yeah, of course we do, but there needs to be mechanisms and processes. I go back to like the Food Policy Council idea. I'm a big proponent of food policy councils right now. And just this idea of having regional groups where you have multiple different like people, representatives, groups sitting at the table together, you know, and this goes back to also this idea that, you know, we can't start at the national or the supranational level. We need to have people in local communities, in regions, sitting together face to face, because that's where the work is happening. But then through that, we could have, and you know, again, this is what this Canadian Food Policy Advisory Council was intended to do, was to have a national voice of representatives, to be at that level, to be informing government, to be going back to their, to be speaking to those people. And we also need international voices. I mean, the food system is an internet, it's a global system. It's not just local. So these problems are not going to be solved at the local level. They're not going to be solved at the international level, global level. They need to be everywhere. And we need, I think, again, evidence in the sense of all ways of knowing included in that to be able to make these decisions, having, you know, people who have access to that information and that knowledge and can speak to each other and can look each other in the eye and can make decisions together. And in that sense, I think, you know, even though, you know, economics tends to take precedence now, I think, you know, to Elaine, you made this point already, but, you know, when we start to think about a food system that actually serves people, serves the environment, right, or not even serves, but like, you know, works with the environment, you know, works with growers, works with harvesters, you know, respects Indigenous people, like if we start to kind of name these values, and if this is ethics-based decision-making or values-based decision-making, I mean, the food system would look very different than it does today. So I do believe that if we had civilian oversight of all these things, that would be a good thing. But it's not just simply saying, oh, we need people, because we need the right mechanisms for people to have their say. Because otherwise you get these power dynamics at play all the time. And you know, you get a bunch of, you know, wealthy white business owners or industry people making decisions, and everyone else just, you know, is kind of at that, and then, you know, sub voices.
I'm just going to jump in and say, you know, if government actually represented us, the ordinary people, they are our civilian oversight body, right? I mean, if. I was reading that, you know, the federal government's food security policy and thinking, oh, I bet Galen Weston is on the phone to Mark Carney. Or probably Mark Carney called him up and warned him and said, yo, we're going to say all this stuff, but you know, we don't really mean it.
Although you're assuming that Mark Carney could get Galen Weston on the phone. I could imagine a scenario. I digress. Please continue.
They're probably golf buddies. I don't know. But then I think, you know, if Loblaws, you know, which controls the largest share of the grocery retail market, is feeling threatened, I think we're going to be seeing some, you know, marketing campaigns to try to reassure us that, oh no, don't worry. Just because our profits have, you know, doubled in the last 6 years, don't worry. You know, I mean, the National Farmers Union did a really nice analysis of the, and they've also just recently released a report on food prices that shows, you know, farmers' share of the food price is at 11%. It hasn't changed at the same time that the grocery profits have doubled in the last 6 years. And one of the things that, of course, is coming under attack right now, I think Alyssa mentioned it, is like the marketing boards, right? I mean, Trump is coming after those in the new trade agreement. Of course, the Globe and Mail is always kind of saying, you know, Canadians would have cheaper milk and dairy if we had American imports, which is bullshit. But that NFU report does a really nice job of showing how the foods, the dairy, the eggs, the chicken, the turkey, those prices have stayed really constant, and farmers' share of the price has stayed really constant, as opposed to beef or pork. And some, they took, it was 11 or 14 products, I think, and looked at farmers' share. And, you know, the farmers are getting squeezed like the customers, the consumers are. It's the corporations that are making off like bandits. So the kind of regulation, I would, you know, why are we giving, you know, consumer rebates to at the gas pumps instead of taxing the corporate profits that are, again, being made at, you know, at our expense? So, sorry, I'm ranting now, but I'll stop.
And I'll just add also the group we've mentioned a few times, but I should just mention in this context too, is food workers across the food chain, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if workers were paid better, if they had sick days, if they had benefits, like all these things, and there's a, you know, it's, I mean, the corporations will argue till they're blue in the face, oh, we do pay them well, we do it. But, you know, if they're not given full-time hours, they don't have access to these kinds of benefits. So, like, you know, it's like we can have these corporations, not just retail, like across the food chain, you know, promise all these wonderful things, but, you know, set up, you know, all these, they're all setting up philanthropic, or, you know, the, you know, to give money away, but like pay your workers better. That's like, and give them full-time hours and give them the benefits they need. Like that in and of itself would make a radical difference in the food, I mean, in society, right?
Well, and let me use that as an opportunity to share an anecdote and then pivot this into a kind of closing round, only because I am kind of conscious of our time, and we will be reconvening again in the future, if only to honor our colleague Sarah Elton, who couldn't make it, unfortunately, to this one, and we do want to have as part of our conversation. I personally, our farm participates in waste diversion, so we go to a grocery store and pick up food waste that we bring to our animals. And partly because of our politics, but also because of my intelligence gathering, we talk to the workers. We make friends with the workers. And it is remarkable the insights and anecdotes they have regarding our food system. And not only do I learn so much from them in terms of them explaining what they see on the ground in terms of people buying the products that sell, the products that don't sell, the products that spoil, I mean, this speaks to something all three of you guys have talked about, which is the need for that bottom-up voice, that bottom-up, for lack of a better phrase, signal amidst the noise. Because I think amongst all the workers in restaurants, in distribution centers, in grocery stores, there is a tremendous amount of intelligence and wisdom and insights into our food system that certainly the government's not tapping into. I don't think industry is tapping into. I'm sure there are some researchers who are tapping into it. But to institutionalize this, to tap it into the broader governance structure, I think would result in a much stronger food system. Alyssa, you've said a lot of really powerful things today that have kind of helped frame a lot of the conversation. And one in particular that I want to come back to was your point about the trade agreements. And the kind of trade agreements as the Trojan horse or the back door, especially around food ingredients. You know, I monitor industry chatter. I monitor what people talk in the industry. And right now, the Canadian industry, both the ag side and the processing side, they're demanding a end of regulation around anything the FDA approves. So anything that's regulatorily kosher in the American market, they want automatically passed, whether it's pesticides, herbicides, additives, you name it. I suspect the public would not be down for this. And this is why I like the way you framed it and the way you described it, because I think you're consciously recognizing that if there was more awareness on this, more narrative around this, it might make the political environment. Am I hallucinating here, or is there an opportunity as the industry goes for a whole new wave of deregulation to kind of help people understand the health consequences, let alone the cultural consequences of these types of big policy moves?
I think you're right. I don't think you're paranoid. The American government has egg gag laws. You cannot film a slaughterhouse. Canada has some of those laws. They don't want people knowing what's happening. You're not paranoid, because if people knew, they would maybe boycott more of those types of things. Carney just pushed some pesticide thing in a really slippery way on, you know, page 7 in fine print. I think most people don't realize that either. So I think that that's part of our job as activists and educators and organizers. I'm glad Elena and Charles, you know, spoke to farmers. You know, what would our food system look like if farmers were on the boards of these, you know, grocery stores? That might look automatically different. I think, unfortunately, grocery stores care about share and shareholders, and that's it. And I think it's complicated, because it's obviously embroiled in larger capitalist systems. But we're getting at some of these strings. Like you, I kind of hope that there is an unraveling. Definitely, we have, you know, there's no shortage of work to do. But I think raising these issues in terms of some of the effects on our health, and I think that's where a lot of people, I mean, not to get too grim, but, you know, the food-related health diseases are really, really high in Canada and the United States. So, yeah, we should be absolutely concerned about, you know, a carte blanche of U.S. food being introduced. And we should be absolutely protesting these egg gag laws. What about, you know, freedom of information? I don't know where that's going legally, but I think that that's an important question.
Elaine, you look like you're ready to jump in.
No, I'm sitting like nodding with Alyssa. Yeah.
Well, and you know, short of having, again, I think the idea of the grocery as media environment suggests that food is media, food is culture, food is a gift. And I think we do need to be thinking about different spaces. The farmers market's the outdoor one. I think an indoor one is also required for our challenging climate. But why don't we do a final go round? And I'll throw back to you, Elaine, on this question. As I said, we are going to reconvene. It probably won't be until later in the summer due to the nature of schedules and such. But what are some closing thoughts? What are some kind of, for lack of a better phrase, lazy research questions that we can be contemplating? Because I think there's two things that I've learned from today's conversation. The government is starting to take this stuff seriously. It doesn't mean that they're listening, but it does mean that they're starting to use the language that suggests maybe this is a growing political issue. I certainly think it is. And then the other, that there is an opportunity for new conversations, for new discourse, for new concepts, for new ideas. And the technology is there for that. Certainly when it comes to sharing case examples, let alone for facilitating new ways of, you know, whether it's a food terminal or whether it's a user-based co-op. So, closing thoughts, questions to think about, eyes on the radar. With the other thing we didn't talk about today, which you can touch upon, but not too deep because we are trying to close, is the climate crisis is sure coming to the foreground. And we're seeing this when it comes to us having to deal with heat. But I can tell you that farmers are having a hard time with moisture, with drought, with extremities of climate. So the food crisis could be getting a whole lot worse, you know, a war in the Strait of Hormuz notwithstanding.
Yeah.
With that said, let's each take a turn to take us out. Otherwise, I suspect we could be getting even deeper and deeper into this. So, Elaine, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, Jesse, I think I'm sitting here just feeling really grateful for your initiative on the fact that you're doing this podcast. I'm really excited to kind of go back through season one and listen to all your interviews, because I really appreciate your engagement and your thoughtful questions and the way you're provocative, your provocations. And I guess I just want to throw it back to you to say, like, I'm curious about what motivated you to start this, because I think I don't know about Charles or Alyssa, but I was thinking I need to send out a link to your podcast to the Canadian Association for Food Studies, because I didn't, when you sent me the initial email, I was like, who the heck is this guy? And do I really want to be part of a future herd? I don't know. but I think I was just actually chatting this morning with the person who's going to be teaching my introductory food systems course now that I'm retiring. And I sent her a link to the podcast. I said, you could use this as a teaching resource. It's incredible. Just looking at the people you've already interviewed and the kind of diversity of voices. So I kind of want to throw it back to you and say, what motivated this?
I can answer that very quickly because I've already alluded to it today. I think we have a political opportunity. Mm-hmm. And part of it was I've been going to agricultural conferences, like industry conferences, for the last 6 years. And the sand is shifting. The political climate is shifting. And I think there's a leadership vacuum, a policy vacuum. And so I'm reaching out to friends and saying, come on, let's go. We got an opportunity here. Charles and then Alyssa.
Elaine said such nice things. No, I agree with everything she said about you and your podcast. Actually, when I was saying when Jesse first contacted me, I was a bit fanboy-ish because I used to listen to Jesse on CBC all the time, and that's great. But so yeah, and I think this kind of engagement is really valuable. One closing thought I have, maybe a synthesis thought a little bit, is what I was talking about a bit. We've all kind of talked about different ways, but this evidence-informed policy, or maybe a better way to say it, I was thinking about better ways to say it, like human-centered policy or environmental-centered policy making, because I think we need to be looking always at what's working. Basic income is a great example, or not what's working, but what we have evidence for, we know works, we've done the work, what is not working, and not just, like really not working again in that broad sense, for people and the environment. We need everyone's voice. And when I say everyone, I mean, not just, the academics and the ad policy, the industry people and the lawyers and the people who get to talk to government, but we need, the farmers and the fishers and the indigenous communities, the workers, all these folks. But finally, I think we also, again, something I've said, we need mechanisms for this. We can't just say, oh, we'll invite everyone. We need more than a kind of, decision-making structure. We just say, everyone get around the table and we'll just talk it out, because ultimately there are some people who have a much more powerful voice because they have experience and training and resources, and others who don't. So we need proper mechanisms. And I've suggested food policy councils or food policy groups as a model for that, but there's others. So I think ways to think about, again, human environmental centered policy or decision-making that includes everyone's voice and the mechanisms in place to really facilitate that process.
Right on. Alyssa.
Yeah, I agree with Charles. I think it's a kind of a lot of, what's the word, like multifaceted approaches. And I agree with you. I do think we have an opportunity. I think in terms of, having conversations with friends and family, I think bringing your extra zucchinis to your neighbor and offering that as a gift. I think asking hard questions of our policy and political leaders around food, sharing information about food. I think keeping it all, we have that opportunity. I think there's a lot happening right now. And I think people are generally trying to be aware and trying to be interested, but also genuinely concerned about food in terms of climate and those types of things. I also think on the heels of the pandemic, there's that opportunity. There was a glimmer, right, of people kind of returning to homemade food and those types of things. So what can we carry from that? But I think, yeah, just keeping it on the, not to end on a food metaphor or pun, but like keeping food on the table as a conversation point, because it is related to so many things. But change is possible in that.
Well, and to employ that metaphor, I mean, I think that goes back to why I see this as a political opportunity. Almost all the big public policy debates, almost all the big political conflicts of my lifetime have been, there is no middle ground, right? It's a battle, whether left and right, whether between powerful and the powerless. But food seems like an exception. Food seems like the place where there is, however rare, a genuine chance for common ground, a genuine chance for swing voters to be everybody, and that the more we break bread together, the more that we could find that common ground. This could be the naive end of Jesse's spectrum, with the other side being paranoia, but nonetheless, I think making this a very worthy endeavor. Thank you all very much for your time, your patience, your wisdom. We will reconvene only because we did promise Sarah that we would, but also because I am so thoroughly enjoying these conversations that it is helping keeping the dystopia at bay, at least for now, amidst this sprawling poly crisis. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jesse.
One of the things I love about convening this group of critical scholars is the sense of momentum. I've harped on this before, that the only way in which we can enable the innovation, prosperity, and really true potential of the agri-food sector is to integrate as diverse perspectives as possible. And that is, if anything, what we're trying to accomplish with this ongoing food studies panel. And it doesn't just end here. This isn't just about criticism or imagining alternatives, quite the opposite. There's a magic to the way in which the Future Herd does not require consensus, does not require permission or even invitation. It's just momentum. It's just starting to run with other goats in the herd and building a sense that you're onto something. That there's real possibility, and not just possibility, but empowerment, and a new concept, not just of food, but of society as a whole. And in any other podcast, in any other setting, maybe in any other classroom, that would be abstract. But not here at the Future Herd, where we're talking about tangible structure, institutions, policy, technology, and most importantly, leadership. Now, a brief word on the technology of today's production. If you were listening, hopefully you couldn't tell any difference. If you were watching, you might have noticed it was a little off. We had to bail to use Google Meet as a backup, which meant I wasn't always on screen as part of the episode, which I think adds to the appeal. Who wants to look at this? Thanks for tuning in. Thefutureherd.ca is the website. The book club, Feed the People, was Elaine Powers' idea, so she will be participating in that book club, and I hope you do too. Find out more on the website, email us at hello@thefutureherd.ca, and share this episode with your friends and even your enemies.